Well, hey, buddy, I'm Charlie Behan. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really glad to be here tonight, and I'm very excited that Bruce asked me to introduce him. Special thanks for Andy for being here, John for being here, Mike and Sherry. Right? Okay. Welcome to the Best Damn Group in Nashville. But listen, our speaker just a couple weeks ago celebrated his 10th anniversary. 10 years since his last drink, and a couple weeks ago, he invited a couple of Navy buddies over here, and it was really interesting to talk to them. One of them got sober 30 years ago, the other one got sober 20 years ago, and then Bruce shows up at 10 years, so and they hadn't seen each other in years, so it was a great story for me to share, to hear. And but as far as Bruce goes, he's been coming around many years here to the Yet Group, and he's just been a joy to listen to. His New York accent will really spice up his experience, strength, and hope. He always has something very knowledgeable to share, and I can't wait to hear the rest of his story. But we were at the fish fry, and we were talking about who's speaking tonight. Oh, Bruce is speaking. I said, well, he spoke there before. And I said, I don't think so. And somebody said, no, Bruce and Carolyn both spoke, but it was over at Shade Tree. Is that right? Was here?
Yep.
Well, I missed it.
No, my sister died on the 29th of February, and it was right here.
Well, you'd know. Well, I missed that one because I'd remember this story. So without further ado, let me introduce Bruce Duke.
Well, howdy, y'all. I'm Bruce. I'm an alcoholic. Really glad to be here tonight, and thanks, Charlie, for that. Before I start, I want to say a couple of things. If I say anything so profound tonight, know that it's not coming from me. That's coming from you all, yous guys, that I've heard you talk about before. I've heard you say different things. You know, back home, I used to hear things like keep coming back and don't leave before the miracle happens. And there's another one that says have a good time, have a good night unless you got other plans, you know. And then I come down here and I hear pearls of wisdom. I asked somebody how they were doing. They said, I'm hanging in there like a biscuit. Or I'm living in the tall cotton. You know, those are the words of wisdom that I heard when I came down here. So I would talk to my daughter up in New York, and I told her that one time. And she says, how's things going, Daddy? I said, I'm hanging in there like a biscuit. And I hear, what? You need to get your ass back up here in New York. So, anyhow. That was some of the stuff. And then some of the first people I met down here was a pretty cool introduction, too. The first meeting I went to was at Shade Tree. It was a noon meeting. I met this fellow named John B. And he walks up to me, and I figured he was just another drunk. And he comes up and he says, can you tell me if the bus to Birmingham stops here? And I says, what? So then I knew he was just pulling my leg. Then the next one was Buster. And I met Buster. He come up to me in front of Shade Tree. He says, you're one of them damn Yankees, ain't you? And I says, yes. I says, yes, I am. He says, if my great-great-granddaddy knew I was talking to you, he'd be rolling over in his grave. And I said, it was probably my great-great-granddaddy to put him there. So that was my introduction to down here. But I'm the oldest of five boys, grew up on Long Island. I don't want to say it was a dysfunctional household because I didn't know that at the time. It was just a household, and it was a house that we grew up in. You know, my mother and father had divorced when I was 4 years old, so there was only the three of us in the beginning, and then my mother remarried, and there was two more of us. And my stepfather, his name was Russell, but we called him Rusty. And when my brothers and I, the three of us, the original brothers, talk about it. We talk about the Rustonian era because that's what it was. Now, I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not, but he was an abusive drunk. He didn't like me. I didn't like him, you know. So being the oldest son and also the first grandson of my generation, my grandfather was always like, I was number one. I could do no wrong. But if... my grandfather had told him at one time, he said, don't ever lay a hand on him, meaning me. So he never did. He tried one time. But after that, he never did. But through the next 6 years that I lived in that house with him, he used to beat up on my brother. He would go to work, stop the firehouse on the way home, get drunk, and find a reason to pick a fight with one of my brothers or my mother and end up wailing on one or two of the kids. And at, you know, 10 or 11 years old, all I could do was cry. You know, I was scared. I couldn't do nothing. So that's where he gave me the nickname Sissy Mary. And that worked out real well in our relationship for the next 6 years that I was still at that house. Further on down the road, my brothers and I were out doing forced manual labor. You know, we were raking leaves in the yard. And I guess one of my brothers had thrown something at me, and I threw something back at him. And the old man comes stumbling out there and says, "You two guys are going to fight like men." And I was 12. My brother was 10 and a half. Now, my 10 and a half year old brother was an epileptic. So we were always told you can't hit him in the head. You know, I mean, what do we know? I saw him have his first seizure, scared the shit out of me also. But anyway, the old man says, "You guys are going to fight like men. None of this hollering at each other and all that kind of stuff." So he did. Since he couldn't hit me, he took my brother's fist. He stood behind my brother, grabbed his fist, and was throwing punches at me. And I remember looking out, and all the neighbors were around watching this whole scene take place. You know, my mother was at work, so she didn't know what was going on. Well, that was another episode in Rustonianism that I guess it sort of set me up for where I got to being pretty angry. I was an angry kid, and I stole from him every chance I got. You know, anything I could do to piss him off, I did. You know, and he was a gun nut. He was really into guns. And in New York at the time, well, even way back then, you couldn't carry handguns and all that kind of stuff. Guns were still pretty tough to get. But he was a hunter, and he loaded his own ammunition, and he used to keep shotguns in the house. So when I was 16, he came home one night, beat up on one of my brothers. He looked at me and says, "What you going to do about it?" I said, "Your time is coming." And he went back into his bedroom and stumbled and fell asleep. When I went into his gun rack and took out a 12-gauge shotgun while he was snoring on the bed, and I poked him in the forehead with it and woke him up, and I pulled the trigger twice. It was a double barrel. I didn't have it loaded. But I told him at that point, I says, "It's that easy. I'll end your life in a heartbeat." And the next day I was back out of the house living with my grandparents, you know, and but I got what I wanted, which was out of that house, you know. Later on down the road, you know, another 10, 20 years down the road, Rusty and my mother had split up at this point, and he was living down the city of Long Beach. And he had arrested him for hunting rabbits in the city of Long Beach, walking down Main Street with a shotgun. Now, you can't hunt rabbits in the city of Long Beach. They don't like that. You know, so they took him away, put him in it was Pilgrim State Mental Hospital out on Long Island. They put him in there to dry him out or whatever they were going to do. And my brothers and I got to talking about it. Now, by this point, I was an electrician. Two of my other brothers were electrician. And my youngest brother, who was the son of Rusty, was talking about they're going to do electric shock therapy. So I volunteered to do the electric shock therapy for him. And I was asked by my brother, you know, not to go there. You know, it's still my father. Anyhow, that was the Rustonian era. Drinks were everywhere. I mean, I was not into drinking at that point. I hadn't been introduced to it yet. I was smoking at 10 years old. I was stealing everything I could get, and lying and cheating and doing all that kind of stuff, cutting out of school. Because he used to have a silver dollar collection that his father had left him. And every once in a while, I'd go in there and pinch one of them silver dollars. And I'd go down to candy store after school, because that was my drug of choice. I'd go down to the luncheonette. I'd get me one of them 2-cent long pretzel rods and a Coke. And that was what I had every day. So my habits were already forming. I was stealing to get what I wanted. I got what I wanted, and I didn't care about the consequences. Later on down the road, after him and my mother had split up, my mother ended up marrying her boss, and that was Gordon. And that became the Gordonian era, you know. Now, Gordon was a stand-up guy. He really was. A hard worker, a man of principles, and he treated us all okay, you know, all of us. My younger brothers, who had to grow up with him in that house after, because we were already gone and out on our own. My youngest two brothers are 10 and 13 years younger than I am. So when Rusty came along, when Gordon came along, I was already out of the house. But he was strict, a disciplinarian. But, you know, at this point in my life, I had accepted who he was. You know, I mean, you treat my mother right. My mother had me when she was 16 years old. So here was some stability for her. And they stayed married for 40 years, you know. And we didn't always see eye to eye on things, but we really didn't have to, you know. But he treated my mother right, and that was the deal. So it's about that time, it's that 15 years old, when I was living with my grandparents. I'd gone to a different school. I met this girl, Peggy. She was a year younger than I was. We were both in high school. I smoked my first joint. If anybody has, I hope nobody takes offense to this, but drugs are a very big part of my story, you know. We had already been drinking. In those days, we used to go to a place called Lincoln Appetizing, because if you could reach the county, you could buy beer. And at 15 and 16 years old, we used to go and get the Schaefer half quarts, cans of Schaefer half quarts. And we'd drink in an empty lot. We used to call the barrels, because there were empty barrels in there. And in this place, you walk a little bit further through the empty lot, and that was a place where the nuns slept, a convent or whatever it was at the Catholic Church. So me and my friend Gary Jensen, we decided we're going to climb up a tree and drink, because when the cops would come through every night or two just to go through the lot to chase everybody. But we climbed up a tree, and while we're sitting up in a tree drinking and goofing around with each other, I happen to look over, and there's a nun getting ready to get in the shower, and I said, "Oh Christ, I'm going to hell already," you know. I mean, I wasn't Catholic, but I knew I probably was seeing something I shouldn't see, you know. So that started my drinking career. And about the same time as when I met Peggy, and we were behind a high school, and she rolled the first joint that I ever smoked. And from those days, there was a place we used to hang out in Oceanside. It was called Nathan's. And across the street from Nathan's was a head shop. Back in, this is 67, 68, the head shops were real big, you know. You would never get incense and get all kinds of stuff. But drugs, that's where I got introduced more to drugs and alcohol. I mean, I was never a big fan of the drink. I never really liked it. I used it later on in my life to come down. But it was very rarely what took me off. You know, I usually started off on something else. And from there, I just took off. I liked whatever I was doing that made me feel different. You know, I didn't have to answer to anybody. I didn't feel I had to answer to anybody. You know, I was entitled at this point. You know, I'm living my life. I'm doing what I want to do. I was working for the phone company. Jumping ahead a couple of years, I met this other girl, Kathy, who was a friend of Peggy's. Now, we used to get out to the beach in the summertime. We'd get out to Long Beach, and we'd sit under the boardwalk, and we would drink, and we would sniff glue, and whatever else we could get a hold of at that particular time. Well, I hung out with a bunch of guys who, at the Tay, in those days, they used to call them the greasers, the hoods. There was the greasers over here, and there was the collegiate guys over here, the fraternities and the ones who were going to college. You know, we didn't like each other very much. I don't know why, but we just didn't, you know. Well, we got a good buzz on and decided there was a fraternity having a party further down the beach. And we decided we were going to get out and steal their beer, which we did. And they came looking for us, and it was a big fight on the boardwalk and all this kind of stuff. And this girl, Kathy, came over and picked me up off the boardwalk because I was laying down with a big old bloody eye. And I ended up, we started dating. And like I said, we were both in high school still at the time. And I graduated in 69, she graduated in 70, but by June of 70, she was pregnant. Don't know how that happened. But at 19 years old, I was a father, Kim, my first daughter. Well, that marriage lasted about a year and a half. I remember her father, when we went to tell her father about this, Kathy being pregnant, he says, you know, you don't have to marry her if you don't want to. You don't have to. I don't want to see you going through a divorce in 2 years. And I was, no, man, I got to do the right thing. We're going to get married. You know, we got married. I had a job at a phone company. My good friend Gary Jensen, remember from the beer up in the tree days? We still hung out pretty regular. So I would go to work, and I'd stop off at the bar because that's what my old Rustonian era role model taught me, and I come home a couple of hours later with a buzz on. So couple of times we got into a battle a few times, and my wife, Kathy, and one day I remembered, it was towards the end, and we were screaming and hollering at each other. And finally I just stopped, I sat back, and I said, "What did I do to piss you off this time?" And she looks at me straight in the eye, and she says, "That thing you do with your chest where it goes in and out." She says, "You're still breathing. That's what I did to piss her off this time." So Kathy and I split up. I hung out on the street and did what I did for another year or so, and decided another great decision on my part was that I needed some discipline in my life. So I went and I joined the Navy, because that's where I'm going to get all kinds of discipline, you know. So I went away to boot camp. Kathy jumped the state, went to New Mexico, and about a year into my enlistment, I got a letter from her saying she was getting married again and wanting to know if her husband could adopt my daughter, Kim. Now, thinking to myself, looking back at it now as a selfish move, but at the time it was like, I grew up in a household where my last name was different from my brother's last names and from my father's last name, my stepfather's last name. So I didn't want my daughter to have that same thing. So I let the adoption go through. Oh, I was against advice of the military who told me not to do it, but I said, no, it's the right thing to do, and I did it. So years go by. Never knew where Kim was, never knew where Kathy was. Didn't really care where Kathy was, but I never knew where Kim was. But I drank through my whole military career. I have thrown up in every country in the Mediterranean, because you got to try the different alcohol and the different pills. And, you know, you can go to the pharmacias over in Italy or Spain. I don't remember what it was now, but you used to be able to get 10 milligram Valiums over the counter like you would aspirins here. So that was my military career. They taught me a trade. I went to school to become an electrician, and I had a collateral duty on ship. They asked anybody who wanted to go to Florida for a school for 8 weeks, and I was homeported in Jersey, up in Earl, New Jersey, right across from the Statue of Liberty and the World Trade Center. You could see those buildings from where we were. And so I says, yeah, I'll take that school. It's an 8-week course. I'm going down to Jacksonville, Florida, and while I'm in Jacksonville, the ship is sailing over to the Mediterranean. Now, I've already taken a cruise from here to the Mediterranean. It's 10 days across in the ocean on a ship doing this shit for 10 days. And I said, I'll take the school, and you guys can fly me over to the ship and meet the ship in Italy, which is what we ended up doing. But the best part about this collateral duty that I had signed up for, it was what they call a DAPA. It was a, it was a drug abuse representative. What I would do is, if anybody on the ship had a drug problem or an alcohol problem, they would come to me because I had 8 weeks of counseling. And meanwhile, I was selling drugs on the ship. So I was the officers all thought, hey, this guy is a stand-up guy. He's solid. So after doing this for a while, I got to be friends with the Master at Arms Force, which on the ship is the police. They're the military police on board ship. And so when we were overseas, I got to know when we were coming back to the country what day the customs would fly dogs out to the ship, and they would run the ship, you know, looking for drugs coming back from other states or from the other countries. So I always knew when the dogs were coming on board, and I would tell the guys on the ship that I dealt with, dogs are coming. Put all your shit in the engine room, because the dogs cannot operate in the engine room. Something about the fuel oil and everything else, it just messed them up. So as part of doing this, I got my pay, which was my cut of what we had when we came back from overseas. And over there, it was all hash. We were bringing hash back from different parts of the Mediterranean. So fast forward a little while, Master at Arms Force is on to me, but they can't pin me with nothing. They tried for a long, long time, and they could never find, they all knew, but they couldn't prove anything. Well, we were in the shipyards in Philadelphia. I was working part-time after my hours at a 7-Eleven store, stealing beer out of the 7-Eleven store for a couple of guys on the ship that used to come in. And they got me on tape stealing a case of beer and buying marijuana over the counter. So I got locked up at the Camden County Jail in Camden, New Jersey. Now, normally you have to wait until the ship sends a representative to come and get you, you know, bring you back to the ship, all that kind of good stuff. So anyhow, nobody was showing up. My cellmate was a vice president of Pagan's Motorcycle Club, and he would ask me what I was in there for, and I told him I felt like an idiot. You know, yeah, I stole some beer and, you know, I had some marijuana on me. And I asked him what he was there for. He says, attempted murder, sexual assault with a broomstick. And I said, oh, shit. This is my cellmate. I'm a young kid. I'm 23 years old. This is shit you see in the movies, you know. But for some reason, maybe it's because I was military or whatever it was, he was all right. I want to say he looked out. He sort of told me the ropes while I was there. So, again, I get back to the ship. Now I've got a court case. I've caught a court case in Jersey, civilian court. And whatever happens in the civilian court, when that's all done, then the military's going to do their thing. Well, it was the first charge for me. It was the first charge I ever had. And the civilians have what they call pretrial intervention. They said, you stay out of trouble for a year and everything is cool, but you got to come to probation once a month for the next 3 months or something like that, and everything will be fine. They weren't drug testing us during those days. I mean, I still did whatever I wanted to do. If I could make it to that probation, I was okay. Well, the commanding officer of the ship says, I'm not going to reward you for what you did. You're restricted to the ship. You're not going to your probation. So now I've got warrants out on me in the state of New Jersey because I'm not showing up for probation. And this all catches up to me 35 years later, and I'll tell you how. That fast forward again on the ship towards the end of my enlistment. I had enlisted originally for 6 years. I was a four-year active and then 2 years more because I went to a school. And the deal was if you took this school, you had to pay him back 2 months for every 1 month that you were in school, the nuclear power program. Now, since I've been arrested, I couldn't go to that nuclear power program because it was very top security stuff. You got an arrest. So what happened, I was coming up on the end of my 4 years, and by my math, by Bruce's math, I only went to school for a month. So that means I owe you 4 years and 2 months. So 4 years and 2 months comes up, and I go up to the personnel office on the ship. I've been on the ship for 3 years. It was a fairly small ammunition ship, and we knew everybody on board. I went up to the yeoman, and I says, when are you guys going to give me the shipping over talk that you give to everybody? You know, I'm in a rate that you need. Normally, you ask me to reenlist, and you're going to promise me an X amount of dollars bonus. He pulls my jacket, and he says, well, no, according to this, you've still got a year and 10 more months to do. I said, what are you talking about? I says, I signed up 2 months for every 1 month of school. Now, I'm still living. See, these are my rules, not the military's. This is how I see it. So, anyway, we're in the yards in Philadelphia. And I said, well, I guess you guys are going to be looking for me. My 4 years and 2 months are up. I come out in E5, still had my uniforms and all this kind of stuff. Packed up my sea bag, took my personnel records, took my pay records, took my health records, threw them all in the sea bag. And I'm walking off the deck, going out, you know, liberty call. So the officer of the deck says, all right, going to do your laundry, hey, Red. You know, because I had a whole bag of clothes with me. And he says, yeah, I'll be back in a couple of years. And they all laughed. Well, I quit the Navy, you know, without benefit of paperwork. But I decided I'm not playing this game anymore. So I came home. My mother had said to me, you got to meet your brother's sister. You know, I said, oh, good. Yeah, here comes hostage number two. So I met Sue. We got married, moved up to New Hampshire. No, a different Sue. Yeah. Moved up to New Hampshire, went to work, working for an electrical contractor, drinking and drugging every day through my second marriage. And what happened was that, I'd taken this job, given him my real Social Security number. I wasn't hiding. See, my great thinking was that, hey, I'm not hiding from you guys. You want me, you know where to find me. I file taxes every year. I do all the other stuff I'm supposed to do. So you guys are coming whenever you're ready. Now, I had a brother, one of my brothers, Gary. He was a cop up in New Hampshire. So every once in a while, I'd ask him to run that NCIC check and ask him if anybody was looking for me. And it always came back, no, nobody's looking for you. But wife number two, had a problem with checks. She liked to write checks on accounts that didn't exist. And one day she called me on a job, and she says, the armed forces police are here for you. And I says, oh, shit, that's not good. So I called my brother, Gary. I says, look, I'm going to go turn myself in. But before I do, I want to stop off and see so-and-so, because I'm not going as straight. So I get to drink my bottle of tequila on the way from New Hampshire to Rhode Island, because that's where the nearest Navy base was, and I turned myself in. And they put me on restriction, obviously restricted to the base, you know. But I came back with my uniforms and my ID card and everything else. Now, at this point, I was gone 2 years and 8 months. And they had to send me back to my original home port, because that's where you had to go for your trial, so, or your court-martial. So they gave me what they call technical arrest orders. Technically, you're under arrest, but you need to get from here to Philadelphia by midnight the day after tomorrow. About a 5-hour drive. It gave me 2 days to get there. So I had my car, and I'm driving to Philadelphia. But I got to stop off on Long Island because I need to see some people. So I see some people, and I do what I'm supposed to do. Go to the Maple Grove Bar, say goodbye to all my good buddies. Go over to the Half Crown Pub, say goodbye to a few more guys over there. Pick up some speed and drive to Philadelphia. I make it to Philadelphia at 1 minute to midnight that night. Go in and get checked in. Again, they put me in a disciplinary barracks. The next day, they have me report to quarters. And I show up in uniform with my ID card and my E5 stripes. You know, I still kept all that stuff. And they gave me a job. He says, here's what you're going to do. You're not restricted to base. You turned yourself in. You're a good guy. You know, we didn't come and get you. So I guess the bottom line to all of this is I skated through a lot of shit that the people that I knew did the same type of thing, did hard time in the brig, did hard time in the jails, got bad conduct discharges. I must have been born under a lucky star, or so I thought at the time, because the job that they gave me was working in officers' quarters. It was basically a motel that when the ships came in, the officers, rather than stay on the ship, could come stay in these barracks. Well, being as how I'm the barracks manager, I got myself a room in officers' quarters. Everybody else is in the disciplinary barracks. All I got to do is check in there once a day, and I go back to my room with the TV set in the room and the bar in the room and all that kind of stuff. You know, it was like being in a Holiday Inn. So, anyhow, week or two goes by in holding, and then my court martial is ready. You know, and I'm before the office at a summary court martial. And they start reading the charges. You know, we have you down for desertion. We have you down for drug sales. And I says, wait a minute. And they started checking the dates. See, the military police, them guys on the ship who were trying to get me for a long, long time for stuff they knew I was doing but couldn't prove, had filed charges against me 6 months and a year after I had already left the ship. So they threw all those charges out. They threw out the desertion. They charged me with absence without leave for 28 days. They asked me if I wanted to come back on active duty. I said, if you put me back on active duty, you're going to be looking for me again. So they gave me a general discharge, general under honorable conditions, because I'd done my 4 years already. And they gave me a check for $1,200 in back pay and unused leave. And I said, if I knew you guys were going to treat me this good, I'd have come back 3 years ago. You know, but that's how my life was. I mean, I just seemed to, for some reason, skate by. And I thought it was a bonus until I reached that point many years later where I'd hit that bottom and got to hear people who had gone through shit, real stuff, and were introduced to these rooms at a much younger age than I was. You know, I had hit that bottom. I was enabled and kept away from my bottom for a long, long time. So I come to find out that the armed forces police were never at my house looking for me. It was a sheriff there to arrest my wife, and she didn't want me to know. So she told me the armed forces police were there. She did me a favor. I didn't have to look over my shoulder for the military police anymore. Now I was all done. So wife number two was gone. I moved back to Long Island from New Hampshire. Promptly met wife number three. You know, we lived together for a year or so. did drugs together. Now, here's a kicker. She was a drug abuse counselor for the county. This is what she did for a living. And we would get high. And then we got married. She got pregnant. Stopped doing all the stuff that she was doing. She was one of those that could still come home at the end of the day and have a drink of scotch and put it away and be done. I didn't understand that. It got to the point in our relationship where I was introduced to cocaine. Now, I love the Mexicans. Cocaine, Jose Cuervo. It was just a great mix for me. And I took off with that. You know, we ended up having a second child. I was at the birth of both of those children, but when the second daughter was born, my dealer lived. I could see outside the window of the hospital where he was, and I knew as soon as all of this stuff was done, that's where I was going. I had already called him. And for the next couple of years that my wife put up with me, I'm one of those guys who go out for bagels on a Sunday morning and might make it back by Wednesday or Thursday, and I never had the bagels when I came back. So by this time, I was approaching what I thought was my bottom. I had an electrical contracting business at this time. I did a lot of work for cash. I did a lot of work for organized crime members who, you know, had me come over and do electrical work for them. They were building a house, and again, it was all a cash business, so I never accounted for anything. And one of the guys was building a house, and he gave me like $10,000 upfront money to go and to get started. Well, I went on vacation for 2 weeks before I came back. They came and got me out of the motel room, you know, that I was crashed out in. So I went back there. They dragged me back to the house, the owner's house, and talked to him. And I figured I was dead at that point, but I really didn't care. I didn't care if I lived or died at that point. I mean, it was, you know, do whatever you're going to do. And a guy, Bob Rossi was his name, says to me, "Well, you've already taken your profit on a job. Now we're going to pay you as you go." And that was the end of it. Skated through another one. You know, skated through another one. But by this time, wife and I were just about done, and I went away to treatment. Now, I went away to treatment not on purpose. See, by this time, my wife and I were broken up, and I was living in a studio apartment somewhere, and one day around the holidays, 1992, I think it was, or 93, see, I used to carry a handgun in those days, and I carried it legally in the state of New York, which was not an easy thing to do. I had a full carry permit with all the other shit that I had in my life. They gave me that. And during the holidays one year, I had reached that point where I hit my knees crying in the bathroom of the studio apartment with the gun in my hand, praying to a God that I did not believe in at this point. "God, if you do exist in this season of miracles, let this gun go off or show me something. Give me something. I need it." Well, obviously the gun didn't go off. I'm here. But there was a knock on my door within 10 minutes. I opened up the door, which us addicts and alcoholics don't like to open up doors when we're in the mix for the most part. But for some reason, I opened up the door. And he says, "Charlie wants you." I'm going, "Oh, shit. Who the hell is Charlie?" You know, I'm thinking, I'm running through my mind. I don't know a Charlie. Charlie Murphy's. We call it the last roundup rest home for drunks. It's not a treatment center, but it's a place you can go and dry out and get to learn how to work this program. So I went, and all of a sudden, I believed in this God. It was a miracle. So I'm talking to my soon-to-be third ex-wife at the time, and I'm telling her, Pamela, a miracle has happened. I told her the whole story, and she says, "That wasn't no miracle." She says, "I called that place to go to your house." So this great spiritual awakening that I had about God had seen and done this for me was really a coincidence at this particular time. And it took me five more years before I started to believe that maybe it was God. And it took me 10 more years before I come back into these rooms to stay. See, I had a sponsor right from the get-go. When I first came in these rooms in 1993, I had a sponsor out in California. Well, he was in New York, but he's out in California now. And when I first walked into those rooms and introduced myself to him, we talked for a little while, and I asked him to sponsor me. And he says, "Okay, I'll sponsor you. But what is it? Tell me one thing that you think would ever take you back out of these rooms again." what would make you want to drink again? And I've shared this in here before. I said, if anything ever happened to any one of my kids, I'd be out of these rooms in a heartbeat and I wouldn't give a shit about none of you. And really what it come down to is that it didn't have to be a fatal disease. It really come down to if she broke a toe, that was my excuse to go drinking. And he told me that's a reservation. He says, you're reserving the right, if anything ever happens to one of your kids, to go and use again. Well, I remembered that from 1993. I had since gotten clean, since gotten sober, and I was 5 years sober living upstate New York. Well, let me back up a little bit. I was almost 1 year sober at a Christmas Eve Alcathon in 2006. December 24th, 2006, I was at a midnight meeting. Sober, not quite a year, I think. And I'm sharing. And unbeknownst to me, my future wife was in that meeting that night. And the next day, at the Alcathons up in New York, they have these, through the whole holiday, there's meetings and there's food and there's all kinds of stuff going on. And I sat at a table talking to Caroline and playing crazy eights with her daughter, who I swear at 8 years old was cheating me. But anyhow, that was my introduction to Caroline. And we got into a relationship. Caroline had some time. And I don't know what it was. My feeling was, if you knew who I was, you wouldn't be sitting here, you know. But there was something about us, some kind of spark. And I, to this day, I don't know what it is, but I believe today it was God. Today I believe that put somebody in my life that would help me grow up and help me find out what family really is, and find out what love really is. And it hasn't been an easy road, should be the first one to tell you. And if you've been in this home group, this is my home group, and I've shared some things sometimes when I'm having a bad hair day over this relationship stuff. But you guys teach me how to get through it. She teaches me how to get through it, you know. And so 19 months after we met, we got married. Now, it was not the kind of church wedding that I believe my wife would have liked to have had. This was her first wedding, her first marriage. This was my fourth, you know. And I minimized it because I've been through it so many times. It was like, well, let's see where this goes. I got married at a place, well, we got married at Saratoga State Park in New York. And half the people at that wedding were from a motorcycle club that I belonged to. Since I had since joined a motorcycle club prior to sobriety. And the other half of the people in that room were from AA. And I think it was pretty cool. Everybody got along. There was no problems. I mean, anybody who was drinking over on that end. Anybody who was sober was over here on this end. And some of them mixed, and they got to talking about old times. A lot of them knew each other from where we were living. And that was the beginning. I put together almost five years in New York when we had made a decision to come down here. And the original reason for coming down here was that my oldest daughter, who had been told for the first 13 years of her life that I was dead, we're going to have a relationship. I wanted to have a relationship with her. She wanted to have one with me. We never had one. By this time, she was 40 years old and had three kids. Well, we had been talking, and she couldn't believe that I was moving down here. We were going down here. I mean, Nashville was not exactly the initial place we were coming to. They lived in Bowling Green. And we had it all scheduled that we're moving down. And on June 11th, 2011, I got a phone call from her mother saying that Kim had passed away last night, died of a drug overdose. And my daughter had put some time together. She did the same struggle that I did in and out of these rooms. And she had put 6 months together. And for whatever reason, picked up the pills one night. I guess she took as much as she used to take when she was active in it, and never woke up. This was one of the first meetings I came to when I got down here, and I shared about that, you know, coming down here. People ask me today, what brought you to the South? I said, well, I want a relationship with my daughter. Quality of life, cost of living, and no snow. And the other thing that brought us to Nashville, more than anything, was that my wife, the year before, had taken a trip. She was heading, was it Austin? San Antonio, to the International Convention. She was coming down here, and she was coming through Nashville. And the axle or the wheel, rear wheel or something on her car broke on the interstate. Come across three lanes of traffic, and was safe. And she ended up here for over a week while he fixed her car and hooked up with some people at 202 who took care of her. You know, a girl in particular knew in recovery that Carolyn had some time and was sort of helping her out. So today, my belief is totally, for whatever reason, we were called to come to Nashville by a power much greater than myself or anybody. There's a reason we came here. You know, it was still close enough to know my grandchildren, but it was a place that we just showed up at. We came here. We came down here like the Beverly Hillbillies out of New York. I'll tell you what, because we had had a yard sale, sold everything we had. I was pulling a trailer, and she was driving a red Hyundai, I think the Hyundai, with two dogs and two cats and her daughter. You know, we couldn't stay in a hotel room. We stayed in a rest stop in Ohio overnight on the way here. And the deal was that we were going to my daughter's house where her husband was going to let us hang out and stay for a while until we got situated. Well, after driving for 2 days, we got to that house in Bowling Green, and he had already had some relatives of his living there. There was no room for us. So now here we are, the Beverly Hillbilly wagon, my truck, the U-Haul, the motorcycle on the back, her car loaded up with stuff piled 10 feet high, and no place to go. And no real money to go and do anything with. But my granddaughter took us into her trailer. And that was another whole story that I'll tell some other time. But we stayed there for about 3 or 4 weeks. And at that point, Carolyn had hooked up a job here at the Ramada Inn over by the stadium. And they had a place for us to stay. They gave us the manager's apartment at the Ramada in Franklin. And we stayed in there, all of us, the two dogs, or the three dogs, the two cats, her daughter, me, and Caroline. And we got to stay there for a couple of months rent-free while she worked at the Ramada. And I was able to start searching for jobs and getting organized. Well, and then this woman who also worked at the for the hotels said she had a house for rent here in Donelson. And that's where we've been for the last 5 years that we're here. You know, when I moved south, my friends would tell me up north because they knew that I had no belief in a God or a higher power or any of that stuff. See, I had committed mortal sin by 12 years old by stealing out of the offering basket to go to a bakery. I knew I was done at that point. When we come down here, I went to work, and I started coming to meetings here, and I heard a lot of God stuff. I never heard a whole lot of God stuff in New York. I mean, there were some that talked about it, but they were, I don't want to say they were shunned, but it was not as acceptable as it is here. And I was told up north that if I didn't find a church when I moved down here, none of you guys were going to talk to me. You know, you had to belong to a church or you weren't going to be part of a community. But I went to work for this company over in downtown and dove into this program. But there was always something missing. There was something. I mean, I wanted that spirituality. I wanted that love of God. I wanted that stuff that you all had that I just, for some reason, couldn't get to. You guys told me that God brought me to AA and AA would bring me back to a God of my understanding. See, I never had a God of my understanding. And then they told me, I've heard in these rooms, somebody shared at a meeting one night, that the God of my recovery is not the God of my childhood. See, that God scared the shit out of me. You know? So we're over at the Opry Mills one day eating lunch outside in the food court there. We're all eating Panda Express or something kind of thing, and I'm with two or three other guys that I work with. And for some reason, I asked them where they went to church. And they all had different places that they went. And this one guy told me about this church downtown called Cross Point. And Carol and I decided we were going to try it. And that was the first time in 50 years that I ever went into a church for a church service other than a wedding, a funeral, or christening or something, that I went because I wanted to go. I knew I needed something. There was something I needed, something I really wanted, and I didn't know where it was. Well, we started going to that church, and I guess about 6 months later, Carol and I both got baptized in that church. You know, I asked God into my life. That's what they told us to do, was suggested that we do, and I wanted to walk that walk. Well, after it was all done, I come back home. My mother was still alive, and I called her up. And I said, Ma, you'll never guess what I did. Now, it's not like she never heard this opening conversation before. What'd you do now? I says, Ma, Carolyn and I got baptized today. And she says, what did you do that for? I had you baptized as a baby. And I says, yeah, Mom, but see, that was your choice. This one is mine. And, you know, I guess after the shock wore off, she's really glad. Now, my mother and I never really had deep conversations about things. We never did, really. But I knew that I was doing, she was good with what I was doing, you know. And it's been great. It has been great for us, you know. I have a love of God in my understanding. I talk to him on a fairly regular basis. I know that there are no coincidences. I know I've been saved by grace, and I didn't have to do a damn thing. All I had to do was be. And that's the stuff that I've learned down here. And I have a very peaceful life today. I mean, that's not to say that we don't, you know, spar every once in a while, but that's just to keep things interesting, you know? But I know where I am. I know where I need to be. I know where my feet are. And I know with that faith that no matter what, everything is going to be all right. Thanks for letting me share.